The interview you're about to hear was edited from Dialogue, Fairchild Industries' key manager and high potential employee development seminar. This interview with the chief executive officer features Edward G. Yule, Fairchild's chairman and CEO, and Dr. Mortimer R. Feinberg, an industrial psychologist and consultant to the company. Dr. Feinberg is chairman of BFS Psychological Associates Incorporated, an executive consulting firm. He is professor emeritus at Baruch College, consultant to many companies, lecturer and conference leader. He's written many articles for business, professional, and general interest publications and has authored 5 books on management. Ed Yule, our chairman and CEO, joined Fairchild in 1961 as president. Much of Fairchild's successful growth has occurred under his leadership. He was previously chief engineer and later general manager at the Martin Company, and after that, vice president and division manager at Ryan Aeronautical. Earlier, he graduated Phi Beta Kappa in engineering physics from Lehigh, which in 1975 awarded him the honorary degree of Doctor of Sciences. Through acquisitions and new programs, Ed Yule has significantly expanded Fairchild's aerospace and high technology business base to include communications and industrial commercial products. Under his direction, the corporation has grown from 3 to 8 divisions and subsidiaries with annual sales in excess of $1 billion with locations throughout the United States and abroad. If you were to look up Ed Yule in Who's Who in America, you would read the following statement by him. Progress is keyed to the individual. It is most important that each of us do his job well, work to maximum capability, and accept total responsibility for results. The trend to submerge the individual in a group or committee must be reversed. Without the pride and conscious skill of the individual, a group, a society, a nation is doomed to mediocrity. Let's get back to building a strong, productive individual, and we will automatically create strong, productive societies and nations. Through this recording, we have the opportunity to get Ed Yule's candid answers to questions about Fairchild's business efforts, its people, and the management of its resources. Initially, Mort Feinberg asks the questions, some of which have been provided by seminar participants.
That's the kind of informality I'd like to kind of structure here today. And it's kind of groundbreaking because it really gives us an opportunity to get inside the head of a chief executive officer who has really been there and who has a tremendous background in management and student in management. And so the first part of my questions will be on structure. And the second part will be a lot of people questions. Now, and you tend to get deeply involved, Ed, when you think things seem to be getting out of hand. In other words, I wouldn't say you're a great respecter of the table of organization.
I try to get less involved now. I think the table of organization is an important document, shows how things should be done, but I don't think one should ever let that get in the way of straightening something out. And I think that one of the very important parts of managing is organizing. And you asked about it. The table of organization, I don't believe that it should be carved in stone. It should be a working thing. It should be a working document so that it... And you ought to be looking at your table of organization regularly. And you ought to ask yourself now, do I have the functions properly set up? I don't think one should get sort of too committed to any one kind of organizational structure over another, because the organization mm-hmm. ought to represent the people that you have in the key positions, what their capabilities are, and a structure that systematically breaks down the various functions that are in your area of responsibility. You should never save any of it for yourself. You've got a job to do, The organization should be so structured that every part of your job is assigned to somebody in the organization so that you can spend your time being the coach, training the people.
Every part of your job should be in the hands of someone else.
Right.
You don't
want to say, well, I've got the job of finance,
and I am
the best guy to run the cost accounting, therefore I'll run the cost accounting while I've got all this other stuff being done somewhere else. You should have every part of it parceled out so that you can do the job of planning, of teaching, of controlling.
And when could you tell people that they should get involved? How do you develop the smell for knowing, gee, I better get out to California tonight?
I really don't know how you do that. I mean, I think that's part of experience, and some people never develop it. When do you get involved? You better get involved when it's important. People say, you know, why do you get involved in the A-10? Well, what the hell else could I spend my time on more important? I think an important point for a manager is to remember what the game is that he's playing and what the objective is. And you can't run the thing like it's a structured thing and I come in the morning, I do this and I do this and I do this and do this and so on. If you do that, you're going to be a second-rate manager. I think you've got to come in the morning and be thinking in terms of what is important. I always try to keep like 10 things that I consider the most important things at Fairchild today. And I keep a list of them.
You know? You do?
Yeah. And when I get done with one, I cross it off, and I usually put another one on. I try to devote my attention to the things that I think are extremely important or critical, so that if the division is going belly up and it's going to be losing, several million dollars, that gets to be pretty important. If you have a problem like that, you've got to do a couple of things. One is you got to get it turned around, but then you've got to get to the point where it's then running on its own again. And one of the most difficult jobs to fill in a company is that of a general manager, you know, because there's a certain amount of entrepreneurial feeling that the guy has to have, and that's pretty rare. Many, many times we've taken people who are good people. They could do run engineering, run finance, whatever, make them a general manager, and very quickly they come apart. And I don't know that there's any way of guaranteeing that a particular individual is going to be a good general manager or not. But I do think that one important factor is a desire to win, a desire to succeed, determination, a willingness to accept responsibility, and then, you know, knowing what the heck is the game, what is important, so that you spend your time and energy on the important things. Training people is one element that's very important.
All right, let's go to compensation. Do you think that money is a prime motivator of people? How do you set the policy, the climate on compensation in this organization?
Well, I think the people that are going to succeed are self-motivating. They challenge themselves and keep raising the standard. Man is a competitive type of animal. I don't mean all of mankind, but certainly. I think there's certainly a lot of self-motivation. But does that mean that you don't have to be compensated? No, because also man is intelligent enough to know when he's being taken advantage of. And I know from my own experience the time I've never sort of said, well, I ought to be paid so much and reached out for that. But if I looked to my right or left and saw the compensation, in my opinion, was unfair, grossly unfair, I became unhappy. And I imagine that's true of most people. Mm-hmm. You don't like to be taken advantage of. And I would certainly hope that we, are trying to treat our people fairly.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't think that we can establish an environment that will make people happy and productive if we don't pay them adequately. On the other hand, I don't think we can pay people so much that we can compensate for a lack of a challenging, satisfying environment.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think a general manager should look like, or what a manager should look like? Everybody here in this room are managers now and people with high potential for the future. What would you try to teach these people based upon your experiences? What's a 10 in your estimate of a general manager?
We used to have these various score sheets, and you score people, and I'd get through looking at them, and I'd say, gee, that's interesting. Guy that had the highest score was my lousiest guy, you know. I said, something wrong, you know, why? And then I'd go back and try to fiddle around with the score and have them all come out. Well, you know, the problem is that you can't put down the characteristics that define an individual. I mean, how could you possibly give Winston Churchill a high enough score for his ability to articulate and present an idea? So, I mean, he drank too much, he smoked the wrong kind of cigars, he screwed up on lots of things. If you had a normal menu, you know, he'd come out like probably a five, and yet he was an outstanding guy. So I don't really go for the structured type of evaluation. I think those structures are great for perhaps stimulating your mind, but the guy that I rate highest is a guy that, number one, does the best job for me. The guy that I can feel confident that when I give him something to do, he'll go and do it. And if he has some problems, we'll come back and we can talk about it. But a fellow that you can feel confident will take the job and do it, and do it well. You have other people that will take a job and they're constantly bringing you back half answers. There's a group of people in the world that are great ones for unloading upward. You know, you give them a job and they go off and start on it, and then next thing you know, they brought it back. And they bring it back in such a way that they try to assign part of the job to you, the boss. And if you're not careful...
They put the monkey back on your back.
And if you're not careful, pretty soon you're doing their job for them. Well, I'm very sensitive to that kind of person. And you should be too. What you ought to do is always make sure that the ball is in the court of the guy that has the job.
Well, what should they look for when that's happening to them, Ed, after all these other people?
For a new man.
You're looking for a new guy. What cues do you look for?
I think you've got to keep turning the problem back to the individual. It's, you know, I don't quite understand. I mean, if you're so stupid that you don't know the guy is putting it back in your court, you know, you've got a bigger problem. And I think...
Well, some people like to have it put back in their court. They love to be, you know, take on everybody's problems.
Yeah.
You know, makes them feel great and important.
Right.
And
then necessary. He ought to become a psychologist instead of a manager.
Okay.
I said organizing was one part of being a manager, and another very important part is developing people and training and setting standards and objectives. And, you know, we have these management reviews, and we look at the top people in each division and have a discussion with their superior. And we're looking at the weaknesses, the strengths, what the boss thinks about them, what his plan is for training the person, and so on. We're also looking for, do they set objectives? I think one of the very good things that we have at Fairchild, we sit down once a year and put down what it is that they expect to accomplish in their organization. The general managers have some dollar objectives which relate to revenue, profit, etc. And they have some other objectives, perhaps in building the business or developing people. And this has taken a long time to refine, but it's very, very good and very important. You ought to do that with people. And, you know, maybe you don't think that's training, but that's a very important way of training people. It gets to the point where you and the guy that works for you understand what you expect of him. And out of that, you ought to be able to identify weaknesses, strengths, and also in your own mind evaluate how well this individual is doing. Did he do what he said he was going to do, or didn't he? And you better have it in measurable terms, so there's no argument or discussion about it. No subjective evaluation, but something that can be measured. And how long do you go along with somebody that isn't doing the job? Yes, you have a responsibility to try to get a person to do the job, but remember, your greater responsibility is to the guy that's good, that wants the opportunity to do that job. That's your greater responsibility, and to the organization to get that job filled right. So there is some length of time that you go along with incompetence or a person that can't do the job. And after you've tried to help them enough, why, you've got to make sure that somehow that void is filled. And the way I determine that is, if it takes me as much time to get this person straightened out, going in the direction he should go, as it would if I did the job myself, I know I've crossed the threshold. And it's time.
That's a good point.
You know, don't do the job of your subordinate. Certain people like to unload up. I think it's important to show, to recommend, point, etc. But never relieve that individual of the responsibility.
The only time you should do that is when you have decided you're no longer going to be with him and he with you.
That's the first time you should relieve him the responsibility. And then you should put somebody else in to take on that responsibility. And, you know, you were on the edge of this. Should, you said, you know, fear or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, should you strive to be loved if you're a manager? I don't think so. I believe that it's important, in other words, for individuals or supervisors to be respected. But I think if you your objective is to have everybody love you, you'll never be a manager.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to respect your people and to have them respect you. And I think it's important that you do your job and you expect mm-hmm. them to do their job. And I think it's that kind of relationship that should exist between a manager and the people that he manages. Well, there are a couple of other things I'd like to mention about organization. I mentioned also, don't get focused in on a particular structure to the point where you don't use the organization in its most constructive form. I used to be a student of, you know, you take and you have to have engineering here and marketing here and so on and so on, and you better go out and find the guy that fits that block. You spend all of your time looking for the guy that's the ideal fit for each block in your organization. You'll never have your organization filled, because there aren't any ideal people. So you better fill the boxes with the people that are best qualified now. And the best people that you have, you want to load up the most. The performers ought to carry a bigger and bigger load, so that don't be afraid to jerk the organization around and put more responsibility on some guy who's your star. That's a good way to build future managers. That's a good way to build additional stars. Span of control, you hear a lot about span of control. When you think in terms of span of control, think about those people that you have to work with and measure and observe. There can be other people in the organization that are perhaps helping you do this, and I don't think you want to consider those or add them into your normal type of span of control, because what you're looking at is how many things can you keep track of at the same time. And I always also look at an organization, and after I look at the functions, I also look at how many people are there in each of those boxes. I think it's very important to look at an organization and ask yourself, how close am I to the guy that's doing the work?
Mm-hmm.
How many times does the word have to go down or come up through the line? Count levels down to the worker.
Count levels down to the worker. You mean that they should look how many levels they are removed from the guy who is making that tire?
Right.
And how far down they have to go before they kick the tire themselves?
Right.
What kind of parameters should they look at? Mm-hmm. I mean, how many steps or how many people?
You ought to make it as few as possible, and I'll give you one way of doing that. And you can say that in most manufacturing organizations, you have like 15 to 20 people reporting to the first level supervisor. You start out with the director of manufacturing, and he has, say, 6 people reporting to him. The next level is 6. 6 times 6 is 36. The next level, 6 times 36, gets to be a pretty big number. And then 20 per first level supervisor, you can have a very large manufacturing organization with it and not be more than 3 levels removed from the worker.
Mm-hmm.
just count it up and ask yourself, you know, is there a better way of doing it? Should I rearrange it some other way? One thing that happens with managers, they get too far removed from the problem. There's nothing wrong with going down and looking at what it is that's the problem. Feeling it, smelling it, tasting it, talking to the guy that's really cutting the material or drilling the hole. But I guarantee it that many times when problems are identified, the problem that's being identified is completely different than the problem that actually exists. So occasionally go down and ask the guy that's sweating the problem through.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be surprised how much you'll learn. Another thing that I feel very strongly about, the most important supervisor in this company is the first level supervisor, because he's the guy that is Mr. Fairchild in the eyes of the worker.
But he's been somewhat forgotten in the industrial structure over the last 10 or 15 years.
And I suspect that's one of the reasons why our productivity has gone to hell.
You know, I may very well be right. That
if I could have one thing that I would like to do at Fairchild, I would like to have an elite core of first-level supervisors, people that were professional, that knew their jobs, that thought well of the company, that were, you know, realize that a supervisor's job is not to be the guy that can drill the roundest hole or the deepest hole, but he's a guy who knows that his job is to organize, to plan, to measure, and to develop his people. If we could do that, in my opinion, we would soon be the biggest company in the aerospace business. So developing people, training, and organization go together, setting standards, evaluate, don't relieve a guy of his responsibility. Be the coach, be the trainer.
Somebody asked the question of how do you see psychological testing?
Well, psychological testing, I look at it as an aid in perhaps counseling or working with an individual. I certainly am not going to take your judgment over mine as to who I'm going to put in a job.
That's right.
I've done that once or twice in my life, and I live to regret it. Not from you, but from...
Oh, I was going to say! I didn't think I'd still be around here, Yule, if you felt that way.
So you've got to depend upon your own judgment. I don't care what kind of testing you do, because a human being is too complicated to test and determine who's going to be the guy. So, but I do think it's a very valuable tool in working with people and trying to understand, you know, perhaps why is there a blind spot, or why do they react this way or that way, and I think it's therefore very valuable.
I've observed you as a psychologist for almost a decade, as a consultant and as a friend, and I think handling stress is very important. How do you handle stress? Do you have any suggestions that you could give to young people?
Well, I think it's something that each individual has to work out on his own, but seems
to me... Do you find jogging helpful? Do you find the physical activity? Do you find hunting?
No, that's all walking away from it. Mm-hmm. I think you've got to face up to a problem, and then you have to coldly decide what it is that you can do about it and what it is you can't do about it. And there's no point in dwelling on the stuff that you can't do anything about. Then the things that you can do something about, you've got to set a plan and say, okay, I'm going to do this and this and this. And, you know, there's no point in constantly looking over your shoulder. You know, each day is a new day, and there's no point in wringing your hands about something that you have absolutely no control over. You know, after all, the world isn't going to come to an end. You know, that's an important point, and that is that I don't think it's wise to sort of overinflate your importance, of the problem. Well, after all, 100 years from now, who's going to remember this meeting or what you did in a particular situation?
But yeah, but the point is that you have to take what you're doing seriously enough so that
but
you pay attention. Okay,
should look upon these events as that earth-shaking. And one of the problems you have in stress is that the individual focuses on a particular problem and gives it a lot more importance in the world around him.
The second question is, what kind of balance do you look for, or don't you look at that, in a man's family life and how it affects his job performance? Things like moving an executive, you want him to move from New York to Dallas. Do you hold it against him if he says, my wife, you know, is up for tenure and I don't think we can make that move now, Ewell.
Family and job, I think people ought to have their private life and they ought to have a company life. And I really am not a devotee of mixing the two. You know, how do you handle stress? One way is to...
Any calls from home.
Right. when you finish the business day, you ought to pull down a little curtain. And I don't want to have to eat the company problem all night as well as all day. And I want to have a private life that's my own life, and then I'll have a company life. I don't feel a person should bring his life, his home life, into the company. If an individual isn't able to make a move because of some family consideration, I certainly think one should understand. If that gets to be a total blockage so that he can only work in one location forevermore, that's got to be a negative, because the job that's the next job may not be in that location, and so it's not a question of holding it against him, it's a question of he's holding it against himself. And having two people working, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's really an individual selection to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you how I make mine. If you want to make yours differently, that's up to you.
Well, we've pretty much did what we had planned to do. I think we have tried to give you a role model. Really, do you see an executive like Ed who is willing to take on this kind of a challenge? He has never did not see any of the questions, did not know what I was going to ask. I think it's, at least from my experience, it's been a unique kind of opportunity. I'm going to recommend that other companies do it if their chief executives are willing to face up to it. We appreciate your questions, your participation, and I hope this has been a meaningful experience for you. Thank you for your attention.